Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 53 of our live monthly Q&A, Ask the Experts with Cinten's employment team. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing here at Cinten's. This is our first live employment Q&A of the new year. So although we're nearly in February, Happy New Year to everyone. Hope the break was good for everybody. It does seem a little bit like quite in the past now, doesn't it? And 2024 is well and truly underway. Our speakers today, we put them on the screen there in front of you. We have once again Associate Catherine Hope, Solicitor Samuel Scott, so welcome to them. And the format is the same as with every month. These are three questions that you've sent to us over the course of the last month, so thank you for that. And we're going to answer them this morning. So straight over to Catherine, who's going to deal with question one of three. Catherine, good morning, and over to you.
Good morning. Thanks, David. Good morning and thanks for joining us for the first of our Q&As of 2024. Samuel and I have got a few questions for you. And the first one is, do we have to meet with an employee who's been accused of alleged misconduct before we invite them to a disciplinary hearing to deal with that allegation? In short, I'd say the answer is always, it's always a good idea. Whether you have to, it depends. And when we talk about whether you have to, and where I'm assuming this question is coming from, is whether it would impact on whether a dismissal, if someone ended up being dismissed, ended up being unfair from an unfair dismissal claim perspective. So that's the way I'm approaching this and looking at it. It's really important when you're dealing with alleged employee misconduct that you need to follow a fair procedure. That is the key here when you're looking at conduct issues. And really what we're looking at here is whether a dismissal could be unfair. And of course, that will only apply, and an employee will only have the right to bring that type of claim when they have 2 years service. So really we're focusing on that when it comes to this question. But in terms of investigations, in most cases, it's going to be a key part of the process. It's fundamental of carrying out that thorough investigation process. And even when dismissal isn't contemplated, it's going to be really important. So where you might be giving a warning or a final written warning. And that's because if you don't carry out a fair disciplinary procedure and the way in which you act, or if you don't do things that you should do, it could end up where an employee has the right to resign and claim constructive unfair dismissal, where they're arguing that you are in fundamental breach of the contract. For example, you've breached the mutual trust and confidence because of the way you've dealt with something, or you've not done certain things that you should have done, and it's really unfair. Going back to dismissal, because we're talking about dismissal here where that is contemplated, you need to think back to the fair dismissal test for an unfair dismissal. A, you have to have a fair reason. So the principal reason for dismissal has to be one of the potentially fair reasons. Here it would be conduct, because we're looking at misconduct, which is a potentially fair reason. And then you have to show that you've acted reasonably in treating the given reason, so misconduct, as sufficient to justify dismissal. So here the tribunal would look at whether you've acted reasonably, and they're taking account of all the circumstances of the case. And we come back to, and this is where the procedural point comes in, when you're looking at whether you acted fairly and reasonably, when it comes to conduct, it's about carrying out a fair disciplinary process. So that's where the procedural point comes in, and we're looking at the investigation stage. The key case, as you'll be aware, when it comes to conduct, is that of Birchall, so the BHS and Birchall case. And that sets out really the minimum that you need to have if you're in a position where you're going to move to terminate someone's contract, where they have 2 years service and it's to do with alleged misconduct. And there you have to show that you genuinely believed in they were guilty of that conduct, misconduct, that you have reasonable grounds for that belief, and that at the time you held that belief, you had carried out as much investigation as was reasonable. So you really have to have that in the back of your mind when you're dealing with disciplinary processes, especially where you're dealing with potential gross misconduct. And then it's really important to also look at the ACAS code of practice, because this underpins a fair disciplinary process. And it's something that the tribunal has to take into account when they're looking at fairness. And also it can obviously have an impact on the amount of compensation that is awarded. That can be increased up to 25% if you're found not to have followed that. So it's really important to look at what that says, excuse me, about investigation, the investigatory meeting and stages. And it says that it's really important to carry out the necessary investigation of the potential disciplinary matters, because you're getting a sense of whether there is a disciplinary case to answer and whether it's appropriate to take it forward to a disciplinary hearing. And it's all about what's reasonable in the situation. And in some cases, that will involve holding an investigatory meeting with the employee before proceeding to a disciplinary hearing. It's about collating that evidence, collecting the information. When you're thinking about investigation, you need to think about how much is required. And you always also need to look back at your own policies, your own disciplinary procedure. There may actually be something in there that says you're saying that actually every time we are dealing with any allegation of misconduct or gross misconduct, we will hold an investigatory meeting with an employee. So you need to check what that says, because it may be that that answers the question for you. If there are factual points to be determined, then yes, you certainly need to hold that meeting with the employee. If you think about it, we're going back to what is a fair procedure, and you have to have enough information that's sufficient to give to an employee at a disciplinary hearing, if it proceeds to that, so that they know exactly what the case is against them and they can respond to that and defend themselves. And also for the person chairing the disciplinary hearing to make a decision as to whether they're guilty or not. In terms of the level investigation, again, it comes down to what's the gravity of the allegations in the case. What sort of evidence do you have? What state is that in? What are the potential consequences for the employee? You know, could it affect their reputation, or could it actually, you know, affect an amount to career loss if they're found guilty? As well, when you're looking at whether this proceeds to a disciplinary, having an investigatory meeting with an employee could really help clear up any misunderstandings. If you have that meeting, it could end up that you find out that actually there's a clear explanation for what's happened and you don't actually need to proceed to a disciplinary. So it's really important to have that stage and to gather that information. You may also identify other information or evidence that you need to collect, or other people you need to speak to. And it saves you having to do that and adjourn things later down the line if things arise at disciplinary that haven't been dealt with already. And it saves time, and it means they can be dealt with before you move to the disciplinary hearing stage. Just going back to ACAS statutory guidance as well, that obviously that says the more serious the offence, the more important it is, and the more that there's a thorough investigation. So going back to where that could affect someone's whole career or reputation. Just going back to the question then, again, as I said at the start, it's more or less always going to be sensible to carry out an investigation, and that would be the safest approach, to meet with an employee and hold an investigatory meeting as part of your overall investigation process. And it may be that actually you speak to them and you carry out further investigation, and you need to speak to them again before you decide that there's a disciplinary case to answer. It's really only going to be the rarest of cases where it would be fair not to. It could still be a fair dismissal. For example, if there is belief in the conduct that can be established by the evidence that you have, that can clearly be established, or someone has admitted to an offence, for example. That being said, it's really important to note that just because someone admits to an offence, it doesn't necessarily follow that that's going to result in a fair dismissal. There may be other things that you need to consider that you haven't, such as mitigation, the context in which that conduct has taken place, which may actually mean that in that particular situation, it's appropriate to give a final written warning as opposed to dismissal. So it's never a clear-cut case. So my advice would always be to have that investigatory meeting. You're covering off all the angles there. So that's that question. I'll pass you over to Samuel for question two.
Hi, everyone. I hope you can hear me, and it's great that you've joined us today for our Q&A in January. So the question that I'm answering today is, should we include overtime pay in the calculation of holiday pay? And the short answer to this is, it's complicated, maybe, and it's going to get easier in the future, and all of the above. It's a complicated regime because of where we get our holiday entitlement from and where we get our holiday pay rules from, and the cross-section between EU law and UK law. In terms of framing this question, the principle under the working time regulations on why individuals get holiday is a health and safety form of legislation to ensure employees get breaks from work and that they can rest and recharge. And the law doesn't want to disincentivize employees from taking that holiday, and therefore the holiday pay rules are set up in a way which incentivizes employees to take their holiday, and therefore if an employee was going to receive less money on their holiday than they would when they were at work, potentially that would lead some individuals to not taking their holiday and not taking their rest breaks, which is the purpose of these rules. So against that backdrop, I'm kind of going to go into all the detail about when you need to include overtime and when you don't need to include overtime. The first important distinction I'd like to make, and I think many of you will be aware of this, is that employees are entitled to 5.6 weeks of annual leave in each leave year which they have. And this is often deemed to be 28 days, as 28 days is often easier. For full-time employees, it's 28 days. If we express it as 5.6 weeks, it makes it easier to calculate in terms of someone who might work part-time, who might work 3 days a week, and then it would be 5.6 weeks of their 3 day week. So of that 5.6 weeks, 4 weeks of it is made up of EU holiday, and there's special rules which apply in relation to that 4 weeks. And then the other 1.6 weeks, which is roughly equivalent to the 8 bank holidays which we get in the UK, comes from UK legislation. So for certain types of calculations, the 4 weeks is treated differently to the 1.6 weeks. And then the rules for calculating whether overtime will be included are set out in the Employment Rights Act. And while the rules are quite complicated, they were firmly established until a series of case law, prominently Bear Scotland, which you may have heard of, which said that the UK's rules in relation to holiday pay didn't comply with the EU rules. And that's where this fracture has happened, which leads to the complicated regime. To make it easier to understand, I'm going to split the situation into three different scenarios. And the three scenarios are employees who have no normal working hours. So this isn't an employee who has 35 hours a week, Monday to Friday. This is an employee who has irregular shifts or a mixed shift pattern. They have no normal set working hours. The second situation will be an employee who has normal working hours, but their pay varies depending on when they do the work or the amount of work that they get done. And this could apply to people who get paid extra or a different rate in the evenings, or people that do piecework and get paid based on the amount of work they produce. And then the final category is normal working hours. So the first two are quite straightforward, you'd be pleased to know. So if an employee or a worker has no normal working hours, all 5.6 weeks of their leave are treated in the same way. And when calculating their holiday pay, you include the average of all remuneration earned in the previous 52 weeks, or the number of complete weeks if the worker has been employed less than 52. And because you're including an average of all remuneration, this will capture overtime payments. So if you have a worker who does no normal working hours, that's the calculation you need to do. You need to look back 52 weeks, omitting weeks where the worker received no pay, or less weeks than 52 if they haven't been employed that long, and include overtime payments as part of an average to calculate what they get on when they're on holiday. So if a worker with no normal working hours does quite a lot of overtime, that's going to factor into their holiday pay calculation. The second situation is a worker which has normal working hours, but pay varies, like I discussed, based on the times of day they do the work or the amount of work that they do. And that's treated in exactly the same way. It's the worker's average remuneration over the 52 weeks before the calculation date, or the number of complete weeks that the worker's been employed. So again, you'll capture any overtime payments that worker has obtained during that reference period that you use. And again, similar to the last situation, all 5.6 weeks of the leave are treated exactly the same. There's no distinction that you need to make. And this is the difficult one now. So a worker with normal working hours. So this is your, to give an example, say an office job. Say you work 5 days a week, 35 hours every single week, Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, 1 hour lunch break. You have normal working hours and you take your 28 days holiday throughout the year. You wouldn't expect that employee to get, if they did overtime a couple of times or throughout the year, you wouldn't typically expect that you need to factor that into the calculation for their holiday pay. And that's because it doesn't use the same reference period that we discussed in the other two situations. So the starting point is that a week's pay for an employee with a worker with normal bonuses, commission payments, premiums, allowances, That's the default position, apart from if it's contractual overtime. So contractual overtime is overtime that the employer is obliged to offer and that the employee is obliged to accept. So in that situation, say you have a contract with an employee and that contract says you have to do 2 hours of overtime every Tuesday and you have to accept that overtime. You have to do it. You can't say no. That would be deemed guaranteed contractual overtime, and that type of overtime has to be included because it's contractual. And that was the default position for a long while until the Bear Scotland case, which I mentioned earlier. And in this case, as well as the Flowers against the East of England Ambulance Trust case, discussed other types of overtime apart from that contractual overtime. Because in lots of situations, it won't be contractual overtime that the employee will be doing. It'll be voluntary overtime, which is more typical, where at the start of the week, you as an employer might say, we have overtime shifts on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Who would like it? If people say no, that's fine. If people say yes, they do it. There's no obligation for that employee to accept it. And an employer asks for overtime when they need it in relation to surges in demand. And these two cases discuss this pattern of voluntary overtime and whether that should also be included in an employer's holiday pay under the working time regulations. And what these judgments came out and said is that if an employee works a settled pattern of voluntary overtime over a period of time, payment for that overtime must be included in their holiday pay. And this is where the complication starts, because there's no definition for what's regular or what's settled. In many cases, it might be obvious. If an employee does 1 hour of overtime every Monday for 52 weeks a year, that's definitely going to be sufficiently regular and settled for it to amount to normal remuneration and for it to be included in that employee's holiday pay calculations. However, if an employee does one Monday a month, or they do one Monday every 2 months, that's less uncertain, and there's no fixed position on whether that should be deemed regular and settled overtime. Luckily, since these judgments have came about over the last few years, the government have recognised that there is some confusion. Employers are struggling to understand when overtime needs to be included in holiday pay. So you may be aware that the definition of a week's pay was changed on the 1st of January 2024 this year. And it's important to say that these changes aren't in force yet, but the changes come into force for holiday leave years starting on or after the 1st of April 2024. So if you are an organisation, which many are, that do holiday years from January to December rather than April to April, you won't be impacted by these changes till the 1st of January 2024. So it's over 11 months till you'll be impacted by these changes. However, if you are an organisation who runs your holiday leave year from in line with the financial year from the 1st of April to the 31st of March, from the 1st of April, you are going to need to comply with this new definition of what holiday pay is and what should be included. And fortunately, what the change does is it does bring normal working hours workers in line with the two easier situations which I discussed before. So what this new definition says is that payments such as overtime payments which have been regularly paid to a worker in the 52 weeks preceding the calculation day, or less weeks if they haven't been in work that long, are included in the calculation. Again, we are using the word regularly, and that's something as an employer that you're going to have to assess by bringing up their overtime schedule and having a look at how regular that actually is. And again, there's no reference point given by the legislation which says if you work every Monday, that's going to be regular. But hopefully in many cases, it'll be easy to see when it is there. The problem, however, which I addressed at the start, was that this new definition only applies to the 4 weeks leave that a worker gets under EU law, and not the 1.6 weeks that a worker gets from domestic legislation. And we often get asked this question about whether employers should make a distinction between one type of leave and the other type of leave and use different rules for one and different rules for the other. As you can guess, this, if you don't do it already, it could be quite an administrative burden to track when which holiday is being used, which is EU leave and which is domestic leave. And it's normally something that which needs to be quite clear in either a contract or a handbook before you can know that a bit more easier, because the contract or the handbook may have some line which states your EU leave or your domestic leave is used first and your EU or domestic leave is used second throughout the year, which means it could be easier to make that calculation when the time comes. So employers do have two choices with this. Either they could just pay the enhanced holiday rate for all 5.6 weeks of leave, or they could make that distinction and then there's an administrative burden associated with that. So in conclusion, these new changes, they're not going to affect workers with no normal working hours or those with normal working hours who pay varies, because these rules are already in place for those workers like we addressed. What these changes affect is workers who do normal working hours, so they work the same days and the same hours every week. And there's going to be additional elements of their remuneration that need to be taken into account in those situations. And again, if you have leave years starting on the 1st of April, you're going to need to make those changes in advance of the 1st of April. If you have leave years January to December, those changes will come into force on the 1st of January 2024. I hope that's helped, and I'll pass back to Catherine for the final question.
Thanks, Samuel. The final question today is about the duty to give certain particulars employment to employees under Section 1 of the Employment Rights Act. And the question is, what is the risk if you fail to do that? Well, in terms of what the duty is, it's you now, well, you have done for some time, but now it also includes workers, but you have to provide employees and now workers with a written statement of particulars of employment. And that's now on or before the first day of employment, a change that came in back in 2020. Now, what you have to provide is broken down into three categories. There are certain terms that you have to have in a principal statement, which has to be given at day one. And that includes some of the main terms such as pay, hours, holiday entitlement, job title, place of work, notice requirements, etc. There are then certain particulars that you can provide in a reasonably accessible document, such as the staff handbook. And that could be things such as your provisions and rights and obligations in terms of sick leave and sick pay, paid leave in terms of statutory holiday, such as maternity, paternity leave and pension information. And then finally, there's some information that can be given in instalments. So it can be given within the 2 months following the start of employment. And that can be certain information about training entitlements and, for example, disciplinary procedures. So it's not that you have to have a detailed contract of employment. This sets out the minimum legally that you need to provide, but most employers will encompass the minimum that they have to provide within a contract of employment. So we tend to see that. So the main thing, if you have your template contracts, is making sure that they are compliant with the requirements of Section 1. What happens if you fail to do that, or if it doesn't quite cover what it needs to? An employee or a worker can complain to an employment tribunal if you fail to provide or you provide inaccurate or non-compliant statement of terms. And they can complain to the employment tribunal, and an employment tribunal can provide, they can confirm what particulars need to be included. They can make an order to amend the particulars, or they can substitute other particulars for those given by you. But it's also important to note that if an employee has another substantive claim, and there's a long list of claims that you can bring that are set out under the Employment Act 2002, and they are successful in that claim, they can also claim financial compensation from the Employment Tribunal. In a sense, they can piggyback on the back of another claim. As long as they're successful in that and it's been decided in their favour, and it doesn't matter if they were awarded any kind of compensation in relation to that initial substantive claim. There's a long list of those claims, but the main ones to be aware of that come up regularly are, for example, an unauthorised deduction of wages, unfair dismissal, an entitlement to a statutory redundancy payment, or a discrimination claim. If they are successful in that claim, the tribunal has to award a compensation, and they have to award a 2 weeks' salary. That's capped at the statutory week's pay. They can also increase that to up to a maximum of 4 weeks pay, but that's if it's deemed to be just and equitable. So that's the situation where they could award financial compensation. So to summarise, they can't bring a standalone claim for compensation on their own. They have to piggyback on the bank on the back of another substantive claim. But if they do have that, then they can claim up to 4 weeks, a maximum of 4 weeks compensation. It may seem low risk in terms of the financial compensation involved, but I imagine if you have a number of disputes that could give rise to that entitlement, then that could, you know, change the situation and increase the financial risk to an organisation. I think it's important also not to just look at the financial risk, but look at your organisation in terms of HR relations with employees. It's really important to be clear as to the terms that an organisation has with their employees. That will make it clear from the outset, and it will hopefully avoid disputes which could arise, for example, if you've just discussed things orally and you're then having to, you're in a situation where it's a he says, she says argument. In practical terms, compensation can be avoided if, for example, if you're dealing with disciplinary procedures or other internal procedures and it comes to light that actually you don't have a Section 1 statement or a contract that complies with that, you can quickly sort that out and remedy that prior to someone bringing a substantive claim if that's where it looks like it's going. And if it hasn't been issued, you can sort that out, as well as if someone is making a complaint about, for example, holiday pay or other pay issues that could again lead into a claim. So that's quite a quick one to end on this morning. Thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks very much to both of you. Enjoyed listening to that one. Very quickly for me, as I say at the end of each of these sessions, we're working hard to continue to produce, release and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk. That includes all 53 episodes. I can't believe we're on episode 53 episodes of this live Q&A with our employment team. There's also an absolute wealth, and I mention this every time, but there is an absolute wealth of employment related content on the website, including our bulletins, our updates, and also we'll be announcing our spring event. So please do look out for that. That will be coming out to you in the next couple of weeks. I popped our speakers' details back on the screen there if you'd like to discuss anything they've raised today further in this or indeed any session. Please don't hesitate to get in touch. Just for those people listening on podcast, contact details via telephone for Catherine 01912263801, email catherine.hope@sintons.co.uk. Samuel, telephone 01912263805. And email samuel.scott@sintons.co.uk. If you haven't heard enough from us by this point, and I appreciate I am droning on, you can also follow the team on Twitter at SintonsHR. We'll be back in February. Thank you once again for listening. Stay safe, everyone, and enjoy February. We will speak to you in a few weeks. Thank you. Take care.